Welcome to the CIO Call, a weekly markets update from Chief Investment Officer Sonia Loud and her team here at Legal & General Investment Management. This episode was recorded earlier today and is intended for investment professionals.
Hello and welcome to our weekly CIO market update, which we're holding for our clients during this period of volatility brought on by the coronavirus outbreak. I'm Max Julius, Head of Content, and I'm delighted to be joined by Sonia Loud, CIO, Colin Reedy, Co-Head of Global Fixed Income, and John Rowe, Head of Multi-Asset Funds. Good morning, everyone. Now, risk assets have stabilized somewhat following the declines seen last week. So I'm going to kick off by asking you, Sonia, what are the key variables we're looking at that would trigger a change of view from us on markets?
Good morning. Thank you very much, Max, and good morning, everyone on the phone. I hope that we will find you all healthy, including your families. And so we're delighted to share some thoughts. Clearly, every week brings new information, and so it's always good to stay on top of these. Max, as you quite rightly asked, it's very important to understand what actually are the determining factors. The big picture is obviously dominated by headlines, and so what we are aiming for is always breaking down our analysis into four main components. First and foremost, our view and the analysis around the virus, how it spreads and how we can get a better handle around its implications. Second, the economic impact. Thirdly, fiscal and monetary response. And I think here in particular, we've had a huge change compared to last week when we had our last call. And then last but not least, the market reaction function and what we are seeing in terms of the dramatic impact of falls and whether valuation levels actually are attractive at this point. So let me go through them quickly one by one. The first one, the coronavirus. You will have heard and read a lot about the reproductive rate R, which we believe is the key variable because it tells you, you know, the average number of people each carrier infects. And you might have read as well that the natural level is around 2.6. So every person infected, if you do not put any containment measures around them, would normally infect another 2.6. Now, logically, if you can bring that reproductive rate below one, then obviously you will see a stagnation and finally a containment of the disease. And so we're watching really on a daily basis on how various countries are doing in terms of bringing that reproductive rate down. And it's clear that for most countries in particular, this is to make sure that health systems are not too overwhelmed. So R is a very important variable, but what we obviously try to understand is if initial containment measures are indeed successful and we are seeing the reproductive rate dropping below one, how quickly actually can economies lift those containment measures, and most importantly, what are the risks about a so-called second wave? So this is very important around the virus, and we will be able to share our current analysis with you after the call. What we do know as well is that obviously in terms of an upside scenario, there's a lot of work around vaccines, there's antiviral medicines, there's a lot going on in the medical field, but for the time being, there's nothing that would effectively help the containment of the virus. And I think realistically, this is probably a 12 to 18 month scenario. Massive testing is playing a big role as well. And again, we're seeing a lot that governments are putting in place to help to get a better handle on the actual number of infected people per country. So having said all this, it's clear that we now have to think about what the economic impact is of all this, because it's very clear that the containment measures right now literally bring the economies to a standstill. And hence, obviously, the expectation for the second quarter of 2020 are truly draconian. And we have to assume that if anything, it might be even worse than what we're currently anticipating. But that's to a large extent, you know, if I can do a little peek preview on markets, obviously has been discounted to a large extent. So for us, the biggest question is, what is actually the trajectory post the second quarter? And this is why I spend so much time on talking about the risks of opening up or lifting containment measures too early, because that clearly could lead to a so-called second wave, which then in turn would trigger more containment measures and obviously a second negative impact on economies. So we have established three scenarios around the economic impact. The first one is that there will be a rapid control of the virus and that we will not see a secondary surge. Again, this is an assumption at this stage, but it's still a scenario that we could potentially see. And I think China's experience might be a realistic scenario here. So this is built on an aggressive initial containment. And I think looking at what's happening across Europe clearly is what governments have in mind. And we have obviously these policies preventing damage to human and physical capital. So this is our first scenario, and that would go very much along the lines of a very bad second quarter 2020, but then a gradual improvement post the second quarter and then into third and fourth quarter and into 2021. The second scenario is one of an on-off containment, and clearly it's this W-shaped wave with the virus. So you lift the containment measures too early, you see a second surge of infections coming along, and hence you have to reimpose containment measures, which means that the economy would get a double whammy potentially around the fourth quarter of this year. Again, it is too early, but it's a realistic assumption that we have to take, and that obviously would have a very damaging impact, particularly around unemployment, because it's clear that those containment measures that we're currently seeing are particularly damaging around the employment levels. The third scenario is probably the most draconian, because that foresees continuous restrictions to remain in place and simply seeing governments unable to remove those containment measures. And as such, obviously, it would have more of a kind of L-shaped impact. So we see a massive drop-off economic activity in the second quarter, and then really a flatlining afterwards, because the economy cannot really recover from these initial drop-offs. So these are the three scenarios we're looking at, and you can see there's still a lot of work in progress, simply because we are learning day by day and how we have to think about the development of the virus and how this will impact, obviously, the economic impact. Now, if we think about the policy measures, because they obviously play a very important role in this, then clearly we have seen a dramatic change in between our call last week and this week, including the big package announced by the US last night, which represents between 6 to 8% of US GDP. And I think the other one I would like to call out, simply it's because it's so unusual, is Germany, who actually has managed to declare COVID-19 as an emergency. And as you might know, Germany has a constitutionalized debt brake, and they need to declare an emergency to be able to move beyond this. But they have announced measures equivalent, like the US, of around 7% of GDP. So a flurry of activity, which obviously is helped by a lot of measures from central banks as well. And I would like to call this out because it is a difference to what we have seen in 2008, 2009, where we predominantly focused on quantitative easing and the monetary side of support measures, whereas now there's a much bigger emphasis and bigger focus on what governments are deciding to do. And that is very interesting. And I know that Colin will pick up some of this, because particularly obviously from a fixed income angle, this is very interesting. So synchronized quantitative easing and fiscal measures in place now, and clearly that has helped to some extent ease the pain in markets, but it's very clear that we have, or that markets have used the opportunity to obviously discount peak uncertainty, and we have had quite unprecedented developments in a very short period of time, very much in line with a very rapid spread that we have seen in the virus. But equity markets globally recorded the worst month on record, and we have obviously seen hence the bear market unfold in a record period of time. I will stop here, because I think that's the right segue into the view on the market and how we are taking the current valuation levels to shed some light on what we're doing.
Yes, that's great. And looking at markets more closely following that, Colin, your team has recently changed its long-term stance on credit. Can you talk us through the new view and the rationale behind it?
Yes, Max. I mean, it was really in recognition of the valuation move, which which I initially touched upon a couple of weeks ago when I was last on the call, and that combined with the enormous policy response that we've now seen delivered to combat the economic fallout from this, we were sort of, it took us a while to get across the line because, you know, initially central bank announcements and policy intervention was almost amateur hour. We had botched responses from the Fed, to a lesser extent the Bank of England, but very much so from the ECB, with Christine Lagarde rumored to apologize to other board members after allowing Italian spreads to get crushed in the market. So miscommunication from central banks contributed significantly to the volatility and has no doubt increased the downside that we've experienced over the last sort of week or so. From a valuation perspective, though, the worst two-month period for investment-grade credit that we have on record took place over a two-month period, the unsurprisingly September and October 2008, around the Lehman crisis. Global investment-grade credit spreads posted an excess return. So this is a return differential between credit and US treasuries of minus 11.3%. And as I say, that was over a two-month period. By close of play on Monday, the same index had returned minus 12% in March alone. So the pace of the move and the scale of it has been pretty breathtaking in any historical frame of reference. For us, obviously, gauging the policy response and seeing authorities finally getting their arms around the issue, it was the Fed on Monday, which got us, their significant intervention got us much more constructive from a risk perspective, and also increased our confidence that the systemic issues that were starting to bubble around liquidity and non-functioning of markets were effectively put to bed. I think there has to be a degree of humility attached to any market view at the moment, given the nature of the challenge. We're definitely not out of the woods. I think that has to be a key takeaway. But their response was substantial, and it's clearly going to be pretty aggressively deployed. I know my colleague John Rowe will talk about this, but you know, it also looks to us like faith in the V-shaped recovery, so the immediate snapback, has been eroded pretty significantly within the consensus narrative, which gave us a little bit more comfort as well. As we look forward, you know, and sort of get past the initial shock of those moves and their scale, we have sort of three longer term concerns. We think the market will start to focus on sort of unsustainable capital structures. I think it's important to point out that, you know, we came into this crisis with companies carrying too much debt for their rating. That is obviously now being amplified by the moves that we've seen, and the fact that, you know, things are going to change. The world will not be the same, and is certainly not getting back to normal, anywhere close to normal, over the next several quarters. For credit as an asset class, we obviously have significant support now, with the Fed now buying the front end of USIG. But we think we have to caveat that. We think it's dangerous to just naively assume that they're going to buy and support every single company. We think they're going to be more judicious in their approach. They will need to see reasonable value. And if a company is about to see its leverage go from 3 to 5 times or 4 to 6 times, that company is going to be downgraded by the agencies and will be a double B or a single B company. And that's going to have to be priced. They will not stand in the way of that normal discrimination and functioning of capital markets. So we think there's still a workout of credit or a workout of balance sheet fundamentals to come through, because we are going to have companies with unsustainable capital structures, and it's not just going to be for one quarter, but going forward. Secondly, as Sonia's alluded to, this is really the first wave of the virus. You know, this is a global challenge, and it requires a global solution, and touches almost every aspect of the planet that we live on. So the Southern Hemisphere is going to have it worse now as they move into their winter. There is much debate about whether we get a second wave in the developed world in autumn, or as we head into winter. The way we are framing this is we're going to have these kind of sort of virus type of echoes that will be a challenge for markets for the remainder of the year. And I think that's important to sort of set that as a key sort of backdrop. I think we'd also highlight that we've got, you know, genuine concerns around reliability of data out of China still, which probably challenges that kind of sort of first in, first out analysis in particular. And finally, on our third concern is obviously the sheer scale of the fiscal response. And the socialising of the costs of this is going on to government balance sheets. So, you know, in the same way after the financial crisis, where, you know, the financial system was bailed out and there was a huge transfer of debt from the private sector to the public sector, we're seeing something similar again. So it won't just be corporates that will be under pressure from a ratings perspective. Sovereign ratings will come under pressure in the fullness of time as well, potentially, you know, significantly in Europe in particular. So, you know, several challenges, but we think the first wave of this sort of bear market process has largely gone through, and there is a lot of protection and break even built into credit spreads at or around this kind of level. But the challenge for us going forward is digging in, is getting much more a much more discriminating approach to who survives and who doesn't, because looking ahead, we don't really know what the going rate for earnings and revenue and EBITDA is for a number of industries, retail, auto, consumer, airlines, these kind of areas we're going to have to kick the tires very, very hard on.
Mm. Right, so more more constructive in the immediate term, but with those longer term concerns going forward. John, moving on to stocks, could you talk us through the asset allocation team's current stance on global equities and the rationale behind this?
Yeah, sure. So to do that, it's worth taking a step back and just thinking about volatility in assets. So one of the things that causes confidence to be undermined and ultimately second-round effects, where the initial shock causes a loss of confidence in the financial system, which in turn creates a negative feedback loop. A lot of that is caused by volatility. And exactly as Colin talked about, a lot of the actions taken by central banks and governments so far have been to bring down the volatility in interest rates, and to bring down the volatility in credit spreads. So those are kind of very direct transmission mechanisms into the real economy and that threaten stability. So they've kind of crushed down the volatility in those areas by saying they'll buy the corporate bonds, by doing QE, by cutting rates. And in doing so, they're kind of crushing down that volatility. Where it's hardest to crush down volatility is in equities. First of all, because it's so controversial for governments to go out and buy equity markets. Yes, they've done it in Japan, but elsewhere they've been very reticent. And secondly, because ultimately companies are leveraged, they have debt, and while policy might look after debt holders, they could still reasonably expect equity holders to take a lot of the pain. And why shouldn't those equity holders take a lot of the pain? After all, they take a lot of the upside in the good times. And so for us, tactically, we remain negative on equities. And the reason for that is that we feel there's still a lot more bad news to come out of the US. It's very noticeable that German consumer confidence versus US consumer confidence has rarely been as big a gap as now, with Germany realizing the size of the problem and the US consumer only back to levels of confidence seen in November, despite this global pandemic. So we think there's a lot more to come from the US. It's clearly a large part of the global equity universe. It's a large part of the investor universe, and it does still feel like the US isn't taking this as seriously as it needs to. We've had this talk from Trump of trying to reopen the economy midway through April, which seems like a fairy tale when you think about what needs to be done to really control the virus. So for that reason, we're tactically negative on equities, taking a longer-term view, a bit like Colin talked about. We are neutral. We were negative until a few weeks ago, and that really reflects just the valuation case is clearly better. If we can avoid those second-round effects, if we can avoid the real economy being decimated over the medium term by this virus, then there's clearly some upside. If all that happens is we have a depressed period of 12 to 18 months, and then we all go back to normal as though none of it ever happened, it was all a terrible dream, then that's clearly a good valuation starting point for equities. So that's where we are on the equity side.
Right, and so that's kind of global equities. Are there any markets around the world that you believe are better insulated from the outbreak?
So right now, what markets seem to love is a recovery story. So we've seen Japan outperforming. We've seen emerging market equities outperforming. Now, if you say to people there's going to be a big global shock, the world economy is going to get hammered, what happens to emerging market equities? Most people's starting point would be that they have a pretty torrid time. But actually, they've held up a lot better in the second half of this drawdown. And the reason for that really has been this recovery story. The idea that China has got this somewhat under control, the idea that actually this might become a Western problem and that emerging markets have somewhat, certainly in China's case, cope with this pretty well. So it's the recovery stories that we're seeing outperforming. So we're seeing that in Japan, we're seeing that in emerging markets. As the news turns in Europe, which at some point it will, you would expect to see potentially that should be a tailwind for Europe. And probably where we need to be a bit nervous right now would actually be the US, because it just doesn't feel like the investor universe there, as well as the consumer, have quite grasped the potential size of the problem.
Right, very interesting.
It's also surprising. Sorry, just very good. It's also surprising. One of the things we often use are alternatives. So things like infrastructure, global real estate, farmland and timberland, forestry. Those are real assets where ultimately there's an asset there that will survive this pandemic. And generally those assets have a lower beta, they tend to fall less when equities fall. But actually they've got really badly caught up in this current fall, and they've fallen about as much as global equities. So from that perspective, that's another area we're starting to think, well, is the value here? They tend to perform when interest rates are lower, and yet actually, despite having a lower equity beta than the general market, they've sold off by about as much. So that's another area that we think could become a bit of a defensive recovery story as we start to look through the volatility.
Right, thank you. And Sonia, moving back to the policy response to the crisis we're facing, should central banks introduce so-called helicopter money?
That's again a question I think that has been widely discussed, and I think it's the question on how effective this would be in the context of people having to stay at home. And I think what you're seeing governments thinking about is far more how can they be most effective in providing people that need cash the most with liquidity, because it's very clear that the impact right now will hit the real economy very, very differently compared to 2008, 2009. And you see already with the complete standstill of economic activity overnight, you obviously will hit self-employed, SMEs, far more than back then. And the difficulty that most governments and central banks included will face is how effectively can we allocate cash to those most in need. And I think, however you want to describe it, it is probably the biggest problem we are facing, and as such that will deserve more attention. You have seen the US overnight with far more detailed measures around particular SMEs and employers. But again, it is more the transmission mechanism that probably has never tested as much, because if you think back in 2008, 2009, it was first and foremost supporting the financial system to provide stability to the overall economy. So it's very different, and hence, despite the fact that the headline numbers are clearly very, very high and seem very impressive, we still have to work out the detail around the transmission mechanism to make sure that this is a really effective relief program for those in need.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really, really interesting point. The questions we need to be asking ourselves now is, what are the changes that need and will take place as a result of this? What does the world look like in 6 and 12 months time? You know, the jobs that disappear here and now, I mean, how many are going to come back? You know, everybody's expecting a spike in unemployment, but, you know, surely given the nature of the threat or the cause of that unemployment, we will require a more generous safety net. You know, for a period societally, surely there is no moral hazard to pay people without expecting work in return. So, you know, do we shift towards almost a Finnish or some form of universal basic income, ensuring that people can continue to consume and that consumption is effectively government funded? Because, you know, it's blatantly obvious to us now that there are certain businesses and industries that are going to be irreparably damaged or changed materially as a result of this. You know, can you see business travel coming back as before? I mean, it's really interesting, you know, the airline industry looking for another bailout and the UK government in particular being relatively sticky about this. You know, does technology, you know, finally replace the face-to-face? Is this the push that was required to get that across the line? I mean, it's fairly clear that, you know, within the space of a few short weeks, working from home is no longer, you know, there's no personal inhibition around it. There's no fear of looking uncommitted to the cause working from home. What does that mean for office space? What does that mean for sort of commercial property values? You know, our relationship with food is clearly changing as we speak. We, you know, we will renationalize supply chains. You can forget tropical fruit all year round. It will be a move to seasonal. You know, this accelerates a long-term theme that we've worked on for a while, and that's the end of the high street as we know it. You know, another big push to online delivery and sales. So there's just so many avenues and areas that we need to dig in to try and sort of future-proof cash flows and make sure that we're picking the right industries and the right stocks. And, you know, but just finishing off for me on climate change, you know, already an established trend that very much had the media cycle prior to the virus. We're already seeing a huge drop in pollution levels around the world. And that shift in behavior has obviously been caused by the virus, but it is an encouraging sign possibly that we can all make, you know, the significant personal sacrifices when faced with a sort of global existential threat.
Right, thanks, Colin. Well, I'd like to thank Sonia and Colin and John for your time today. I'd like to thank our clients for dialing in.
If you've got any questions you'd like to put to the panel next week, please let your usual Elgin representative know. Thank you.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous on the Apple Podcasts app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookouts for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of recording and do not reflect the views of Legal & General Investment Management. Legal & General Investment Management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. And remember to share this podcast with your investment professional friends, colleagues, or even family members. And to find more great content from Legal & General Investment Management, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website.